Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning and welcome to the 11th Circuit. Today our first case is USF Federal Credit Union versus Gateway Radiology Consultants PA. I would just ask that you please identify yourselves before you speak, and we will try to do the same. Case number is 20-13462. And Mr. Salzman, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Joshua Salzman on behalf of the Small Business Administration. SBA acted within its regulatory authority when it determined that entities in active bankruptcy should not receive loans under the Paycheck Protection Program. The bankruptcy court's contrary conclusion rests on a failure to afford SBA the deference to which it's entitled and a misapprehension of the statutory scheme. I can walk through the specific arguments in detail, but I'd like to begin by stepping back and setting the scene. Congress was responding to the potential of the American economy completely cratering.
Counsel, we're familiar with that. If you'd get to the specific issue, it would, this Judge Carnes, it would help me. Let me ask you right off the bat one thing I couldn't tell from your briefs. Are you asserting sovereign immunity as a threshold defense? Are you asserting it in the alternative if we don't agree with you on the merits?
We are not asserting it as a threshold defense, Your Honor. We think the proper way to – we are our preference, frankly, is for you to resolve the merits and to have you uphold this this program, which we think does survive APA review. But we do think that there are problems under Section 634 that preclude the issuance of the injunction here. But we don't see this as a threshold issue that has to be resolved first the way an Article III jurisdictional problem would need to be resolved first. And there are decisions, for example, in the Tradeways case from the bankruptcy court in the District of Maryland that's cited several times in our brief. That's a case, for example, where the court did not think there was an obligation to resolve the 634B issue first and cited some authority to that effect. And we agree that it would be appropriate for you to get to the merits here.
Can I ask you a question about that as well? Actually, it's about the Stern issue that's involved. I guess I can ask each defendant separately, but have you consented? Because I noticed that during one of the hearings, the government was saying that it had not consented, and then afterwards it sought to withdraw the reference. So that's the other issue, the other sort of threshold issue. Have you consented to jurisdiction before the bankruptcy court?
No, we haven't, Your Honor, and Your Honor is right to note that at the very initial hearing, we flagged a possible – this one was before the adversary hearing was – the adversary suit was even filed. We flagged the existence of a possible Stern issue, that the fact that this would be a non-core proceeding. We attempted to withdraw the reference after the court made clear that it was intending to nonetheless resolve the merits of this APA issue. So we haven't consented to this. That being said, we're in an interesting situation here because of the strange posture in which this case reaches this court. And we explained all of this in our filing at the petition stage before the motions panel that was deciding whether to allow for for discretionary direct review here. And the reason things are complicated is because though this is a non-core proceeding as to the injunction that the bankruptcy court lacked authority to decide, it nonetheless incorporated that analysis subsequently into its 364B order that authorized Gateway to take the loan. And while we think that was a misuse of the 364B procedure, that order nonetheless is in fact a core bankruptcy matter that the bankruptcy court had authority to issue. And because that order is wrapped up in the previous conclusion of the court that the rule was invalid and should be enjoined, this court has the effective power to review the merits through that back door, notwithstanding that this is not a court proceeding as to the principal issue here, and notwithstanding the fact that we didn't consent.
This is Judge Anderson speaking. I did see that. You mentioned that in your brief and also in those briefs to the administrative panel. However, I'm not at all sure that you are right, that this is just an easy piggyback ride on the 364 order. It seems to me that unless several things were true, the bankruptcy court did not necessarily have to decide the, I call it the exceeding authority order. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the issue is whether that exceeding authority issue was necessarily decided in order to decide the 364 approval order. That's the Stern v. Marshall test, that the bankruptcy court can issue a final judgment on a non-core matter only if it is necessary in order to resolve a core matter. Is that not the correct test?
I think the right way to think about this at this stage is not in through a Stern versus Marshall lens as to that, but rather perhaps through a pendant jurisdiction lens. So the matter is before the court. I think for the reasons we've touched on, the 364B order is properly before the court. So then if you look at that order, and this is docket number 266, from the main docket, you have an order that says, because the court has determined the rule is unenforceable to the extent that disqualifies the debtor from participating in the Paycheck Protection Program, the court orders it's appropriate to overrule the objections and grant the debtor's motion. And then in the decretal paragraphs, the court specifically purports, this is in the context of the 364B, mind you, to specify that neither loan forgiveness nor the SBA guarantee shall be conditioned on the debtor not being in bankruptcy.
Let me stop you, Judge Anderson, again. Number one, I think the test under pendant appellate jurisdiction is the same, is it not? That, namely, that the decision has to be necessary. You have to necessarily decide it in deciding the other issue.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So it really doesn't matter whether you're talking about the Stern test or the pendant appellate jurisdiction test. Furthermore, I'm not sure anyway that you can just substitute the pendant appellate jurisdiction test, because if the bankruptcy court did not have constitutional authority under Northern Pipeline to issue a final order, then under our Wortley decision, we do not have appellate jurisdiction under 158. Is that not true?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And indeed, we flagged this potential issue at the petition stage for the court. The court nonetheless granted review here. Obviously, that's not binding on this panel, and if there's a jurisdictional defect, obviously that's going to be a bar that's going to prevent the court from reaching it.
So our issue is whether or not it was necessary for the bankruptcy court to resolve the exceeding authority issue in order to resolve the approval order 364 issue. And I'm not at all sure it is, especially because certainly before getting there, the bankruptcy court could have and perhaps should have resolved the falsification issue. And if the falsification issue was resolved against Gateway, I assume that if there were a binding obligation to lend to Gateway, it would be unenforceable. Is that not true?
I suppose that would be correct, Your Honor, yes.
Well, not only that, but let me ask you this, and maybe this is this Judge Carnes again, maybe this is oversimplifying, but the bankruptcy court's function, the core function, is to decide whether or not this debtor can undertake this obligation, this loan, if he can get it, if it can get it. All the bankruptcy court has to say is not whether the lender should give the loan, but whether it's okay for the debtor to take out the loan if the debtor qualifies and can get the lender to give the debtor the loan. Is that too simple?
No, and we wholeheartedly agree that this was, and as we argued in our brief, that this was a misuse of the 364B process here, that nothing in
364B
authorized the bankruptcy court to compel SBA to guarantee a loan or to compel USF Credit Union to lend. So I would certainly agree with that framing. If the court has further questions about the procedural posture, I'm happy to answer them. But I would, in my last 2 minutes, like to at least briefly touch on the merits in case the court does decide that it ultimately can reach them. I do want to emphasize that this was a program that was adopted by Congress utilizing the structure of Section 7A of the Small Business Act. SBA has longstanding authority to set lending criteria. Under that, nothing in the CARES Act displaces SBA's regulatory authority, and on the contrary, SBA was granted additional rulemaking authority under Section 1114. And simply nothing in the statute is contrary or certainly manifestly contrary, which is the applicable standard, to SBA's policy here. Likewise, it was not arbitrary and capricious for SBA to adopt a test that would be administrable and allow it to get hundreds of billions of dollars out the door in a matter of weeks to millions of distinct borrowers by using a streamlined test for determining whether loans would be of sound value.
Let me ask you one last question, and that is, if we disagree with you, jump the line and decide that the statute doesn't waive sovereign immunity against any and all injunctions against the SBA, is that the end of the lawsuit?
If not necessarily, there are a lot of complicating factors here, including the ending of the program. There are statutory deadlines for when these funds need to be used. There were alternative claims pled in the original complaint for declaratory relief. So in light of those claims, I think there's a fair argument to be made that those could not be finally decided by the bankruptcy court. But I think I can't say that under the Fifth Circuit's Hidalgo decision or this court's or the expedient decision, which is precedent in this court, that 364B would necessarily foreclose all litigation of this issue in light of the claims for declaratory relief. But I do think that there's a potential for mootness. I'm not quite sure what would happen at that point. But as a technical matter, no, I don't think it would completely resolve the litigation.
All right, but maybe my question was too broad. It would completely resolve this appeal, would it not?
Yes, I think it would.
Okay.
Let me ask this, Judge Anderson, if I may ask one more question. Did the credit union tell the bankruptcy court that it was no longer a willing lender and that it wanted to rescind the obligation on the basis of that falsification?
I believe it did, though I think I would defer to Ms. Murray on that issue. But I certainly believe that objections were filed by USF, and USF has sought to oppose the 364B order here, citing the false or inaccurate statement as to bankruptcy status.
Thank you, counsel. You've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll hear from Ms. Murray.
Thank you. My name is Megan Murray. I represent USF Federal Credit Union. And in making this Paycheck Protection Program loan to the debtor, Gateway Radiology, under the CARES Act, USF only had two prerequisites. One, that the SBA was going to guarantee the loan, and two, that the debtor's twofold representations were accurate in that it did indeed meet the eligibility requirements under the program, and two, that the funds would be used pursuant to the PPP rules that were enacted. Those are the only two requirements that it had. USF didn't do any additional underwriting because none was required, and as Mr. Salzman noted, none was really encouraged because the focus of the program was to deploy funds very quickly during the pandemic. So USF relied on the SBA's guarantee and the borrower's very limited representations and didn't do its own additional underwriting. But the problem was that neither of the preconditions to the loan were met. The SBA obviously did not guarantee, and the debtor was obviously not eligible, at least under the statutory and framework of the PPP program and the application requirements, that it not be a debtor in bankruptcy. And so in that, USF's free will to make loans was taken away without its consent. As if either one of these preconditions or lack thereof had been disclosed, we would have been in a situation more like Hidalgo, where the debtor was refused the loan, as opposed to here, where USF initially funded the loan into escrow, did not release the funds, and then later, upon the application approval, its intentions were disclosed to the bank, and the fact that it was a debtor in bankruptcy was disclosed to the bank after the fact. So there was really no meeting of the minds as to the intent of the bank to loan a PPP loan to a debtor. The USF's objections regarding the lack of the meeting of the minds was disclosed to the bankruptcy court, as Mr. Salzman noted, but it wasn't ruled on directly. And even if you get around the initial prohibition against enjoining the SBA under Section 634B, it is ironic that the justification for the bankruptcy court's order, at least in part, is that the SBA's risk perception was wrong, because the bankruptcy court has means to enforce its orders and control process in the bankruptcy court and ensure repayment. And the reason it's ironic is because this debtor didn't comply with all of the bankruptcy rules and processes in order to obtain this loan. Its application was incorrect, which puts us where we are today. So I think when you get down to the arbitrary and capricious nature of the argument, there's certainly no guarantee that a bankruptcy court authority would necessarily prevent wrongdoing or necessarily ensure payment of a PPP loan in accordance with the guidelines. And so in that, the bankruptcy court, I think, was inserting its own judgment for that of the SBA. And I think the ultimate question is not whether the bankruptcy court was the SBA was correct in its risk analysis empirically, but whether its decision was reasonable. And I see I'm out of time, so I would request that the court just simply reverse the opinion of the bankruptcy court.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Let's hear from Mr. Udell, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. Morris Udell on behalf of Gateway. I think I need to address the jurisdictional issue first, because although it wasn't really discussed in the briefs, it seems like it's pressing on the court and members of the panel. I think clearly the court has jurisdiction to adjudicate this.
This is Judge Anderson speaking. You are not coming through clear to me. Would you speak loudly and slowly and into your telephone?
No problem, Your Honor.
That's a lot better.
Sure. Well, I need to address the jurisdictional issue, is what I was saying, and I think clearly the court has jurisdiction to address this appeal. I think the SBA, by virtue of asserting their arguments, have simply waived this argument at the jurisdiction. I think they want a ruling on this. Now, obviously,
but let me stop you for just a second, if you don't mind. This is Robin Rosenbaum. With respect to the Stern issue, they can't really waive that, can they? I mean, at this point, if they had objected previously, which they did, and if there was a requirement that if it wasn't necessary for the bankruptcy court to resolve the exceeding authority issue, isn't there a problem? In other words, if the bankruptcy court, as Judge Anderson was alluding to, I think, could have resolved this instead on the falsification issue, possibly, then was this a core issue or a related to issue? I mean, how would it be related to, how would it be inextricably intertwined in that circumstance?
I think it is, because the way it was created was by virtue of an application which inserted a specific, discussion, are you not in bankruptcy? That is not in the statute. That is purely created by the SBA. So it's certainly necessary to get to that if the courts believed, and obviously it did, that it was necessary to identify whether or not that was discriminatory against Chapter 11 debtors.
Judge Carnes, let me ask you this. So your position is that an applicant for a loan can lie, and then when caught in the lie, can argue, well, they didn't have really authority to ask me that question, right?
I wouldn't characterize it as a lie, because there's a dispute as to exactly what happened with the application.
I don't understand that dispute, but to get past the fact that the district court didn't resolve it, I think you have to assume it was a lie, because you can't assume, well, if the district court had resolved it, the district court would have found that it wasn't a deliberate misrepresentation, it was just accidental, however that could have happened, because you're assuming the facts against the party that you're making the decision against. If you're going to say, well, it wasn't false, then fine, the bankruptcy judge should have gone into that.
But I think what the bankruptcy judge did was saying, what was the question presented, and is it applicable? So
what the bankruptcy court did, whether it articulated it this way or not, is, I will assume it was a lie. It doesn't matter because. Don't you agree?
Correct. But his position and the bankruptcy court's position was, the fact that this question discriminates against Chapter 11 debtors obviously
means that they can falsely answer it, is your position.
Correct, if it has no bearing on the application.
As opposed to saying, yes, we are in bankruptcy, but this has no application to the legitimate loan process, and you cannot consider it under the law. Your position is, lie first, explain later if you have to. I'm not criticizing you, and I don't mean you personally, but that's your client's position.
Understood, Your Honor. The position is, first of all, it wasn't a lie, but second of all, if it was, in fact,
Counsel, we're having a problem here. I thought you had agreed with me that the bankruptcy court had assumed, in the course of its decision, had to have assumed that it was a lie, and then basically ruled the only ground it ruled on was, it doesn't matter if it was.
Correct. I thought you were asking for
Then it would help further the analysis if you don't keep protesting that it wasn't a lie. Because it is. Okay. So that's your position. I just wanted to clarify.
Correct.
Answer another question for me, which I asked earlier. And that is, why does the approval process give the bankruptcy judge the authority to order a lender to change the terms of the loan? This is not a pre-bankruptcy loan. This is not a debt of the debtor. This is an ongoing Chapter 11, and a lender says, let's take this hypothetical. Lender says, I'll loan you X amount of money that you want at the rate of 11%. And the debtor applies in the bankruptcy court and says, approve this loan. And the bankruptcy judge says, I think it's a good thing. I think it'll help the process. I think it'll help the debtors and creditors, and I mean the debtor and all the creditors. But I think that loan interest rate is too high. I'm going to knock it down to 8%. Can the bankruptcy judge do that?
I don't believe so, but in this instance, it's whether they are lending at all. In other words,
No.
USF funded the loan.
But they have said without contradiction they would not have funded that loan had they known that Gateway was in bankruptcy. So it seems to me that the bankruptcy court has changed a term or a condition that led to the loan, just like if it had changed the interest rate.
I think it goes back to the core issue, and the core issue is the loan, and I'm using the word loan, it's really a grant. It's not a loan in the ordinary term and the usage of a loan.
Counsel, I'm sorry. I'm giving you an opportunity to persuade me I'm mistaken on what I understand this to be about. The question was whether the bankruptcy court would let the debtor take out this loan. That's what the approval process is. The bankruptcy court, we've agreed, doesn't dictate the terms. It may dictate the terms of approval, but it can't force the lender to accept those terms. So all the bankruptcy court can do is say, I approve this loan or I don't approve this loan. This bankruptcy court went beyond that and said, I approve this loan, and by the way, don't you withdraw. Or you better reinstate the guarantee.
But remember, the loan was approved. The loan was made, and then the bankruptcy court made the determination that USF cannot go back on that. And that was the reasoning was because of the discriminatory nature of the rule created by the SBA as to Chapter 11 debtors, going back to what the overall reason for the loan was. This was not the ordinary business loan. This was a loan in the middle of a pandemic to keep employees employed throughout the country, and in this particular instance, in Pinellas County, Florida. So the bankruptcy court's reasoning was, this loan was approved. You need and my client filed a motion to compel to order the release of those funds. And USF said we wouldn't have issued the loan but for your falsification of the application as to bankruptcy. And that was when it was adjudicated that whether or not that was valid. That's what the court took up. That's what the court discussed. Was it valid to not prevent a loan? To prevent a loan based on Chapter 11 status. And the court's reasoning was clear because a Chapter 11 debtor is under scrutiny from courts and creditors, whereas any person on the street, I'm using the word person, any company with less than 500 workers who is in business as of February 15th, 2020, and had a payroll could obtain this loan, period. And the statute specifically did not exclude Chapter 11 debtors. So that was the reasoning for the court approving and requiring the loan to be used by, to be, you know, allowed to be used by Gateway. Remember, the loan was funded and then held in escrow. So,
you know,
I don't think it was ever adjudicated below specifically or tried by USF on the falsification issue. And the court said it doesn't matter because we're going back to the core issue of the discrimination of Chapter 11 debtors.
You know, I can understand the court conditioning an approval on anything the court wants to condition it on, including my hypothetical about a lower interest rate. But requiring that the loan be made and attaching thereto conditions that weren't negotiated in the loan process is an entirely different thing. And the condition here being attached that wasn't negotiated is you can't withdraw the guarantee because of bankruptcy.
But if we remember, the loan was could not be guaranteed, the guarantee cannot be withdrawn because of the discriminatory nature of the rule, which was arbitrary and capricious. That's why it relates back to that. So I understand that the court's reasoning on and the ordinary business loan. This would make sense, but this is not the ordinary business loan. This is the CARES Act in the middle of a pandemic to get money to employees. So I think when the court looked at that and looked at the reasoning and the actual language of the CARES Act, where there was no justification for eliminating Chapter 11 debtors from receiving these funds, the court made the finding, and the findings were pretty clear, and I think the court's findings specifically and the SBA's actions were arbitrary and capricious because the SBA's reasoning for not allowing Chapter 11 debtors to receive PPP loans or the infrequency of repayment, that is not an issue and was not a factor at all in any PPP loan. Repayment is not a factor. So there's absolutely no underwriting. This is literally a grant program.
Let me ask you this question. Getting back to my concern, and I apologize for reiterating, but it is my main concern about this process. Suppose USF or the SBA had disapproved the loan, hadn't made it. The debtor, Gateway, goes in and asks the judge, says, look, I want you to approve this loan. They hadn't made it, but the reason they didn't make it is they discriminated against me because I'm in Chapter 11. And the court says, okay, I'll approve that loan, and I enjoin the SBA from refusing to approve it, and USF from refusing to make the loan. I mean, it's still the national emergency. We have an economic deal, and Congress wants to get the money out fast as possible. And this is clearly discrimination against somebody in bankruptcy. That's the reason they didn't make or approve the loan. Now, does the bankruptcy court have the authority to order USF and the SBA to make and approve the loan?
It's a tough question, Your Honor. I think in general, but in this instance, I would say yes, because the CARES Act had specific statutory reasoning and groundings, which were to get money out to otherwise
Then, just so I understand you, and then I promise you this is the last question I'll ask. Your position then is that the bankruptcy court would have been authorized to order the SBA to approve a loan it had not approved and USF to agree to make a loan it had not been it had not agreed to make, if the reason they hadn't approved it and hadn't made it was that the applicant was in bankruptcy.
Correct. Because if it was otherwise a discriminatory issue, there's no other reason to not allow the approval.
And that's part of the approval process. The bankruptcy court gets the final say on whether a loan is approved that hasn't been made and whether it is approved by the SBA that hasn't been approved by the SBA.
In a hypothetical world, probably not. But obviously, in this instance, the loan had already been made.
Okay, so your position wouldn't require, wouldn't authorize the bankruptcy court to order the SBA to approve it and USF to make it.
I don't think legally it could. I don't think legally it could.
Okay.
But in this instance, because the loan was approved and the only underwriting done was those two issues and the melded on issue of whether or not the entity is in bankruptcy, that's the reasoning. And that's the reason why the rule which eliminated Chapter 11 debtors from eligibility for these funds was arbitrary and capricious, because there's no other palpable reason to not send the money out to employees or to keep businesses operating during a pandemic. I think in the ordinary course of business, we're not even discussing this, but because of the national emergency, the issue of the CARES Act, the specific findings of the CARES Act, the specific reasoning for why it was created, the SBA's actions were arbitrary and capricious because there's no rhyme or reason tied to it.
This is Judge Anderson talking. So your position, I'm gathering, is that there was a binding contract entered into when the loan was approved, and that binding contract obligation on the part of the credit union to make the loan was presented to the bankruptcy court, and that loan was approved. So, in effect, the bankruptcy court was engaging in a non-core inquiry, enforcing a state law contract to make a loan. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say it was non-core, because the issue related back to whether the loan... I'm sorry.
2 minutes remaining.
Thank you. I lost my train of thought. I would say that it was a core issue because of the fact that the only reason not to pay the loan, so to speak, or allow the use of the loan, was the discriminatory nature of the rule. So the bankruptcy court was basically enforcing an otherwise valid loan. There were only two possible underwriting issues for payment of the loan. Obviously, were you in business? And did you have employees, rent, mortgage, and payroll?
So under your position, a cocaine business that has fewer than 500,000 people is automatically entitled to a PPP loan to be guaranteed and forgiven. Is that right?
Well, obviously it has to be a legal business. So I don't think
that's not in those eligibility requirements in D1, 636A36D1 that you say is the only eligibility requirement.
Well, I believe you have to be an ongoing business concern. An ongoing business concern, illegally could be a cocaine business. That's not a legal ongoing business concern, so I don't believe that would make it eligible.
I understand.
I think my time is wrapping up. So for the reason I stated and the reason I'm brief, I'd ask the court to affirm the bankruptcy court's order and require the loan to be and allow the loan to be used because the loan may actually expire soon based on the PPP program.
Thank you, Mr. Udell. Mr. Salzman.
Thank you, Your Honors. This is Josh Salzman again. I don't have much to add unless the court has questions for me. I think the court's already fully explored several respects in which the bankruptcy court overstepped its authority, both as to the core proceeding, non-core proceeding issue, by enjoining SBA and effectively compelling it to dispense federal funds or to guarantee a loan in violation of 634B, and also in overstepping its authority under the ability to approve credit under 364B of the Bankruptcy Code. If the court does reach the issue...
This is Judge Anderson. Is the gist of this these orders by the Bankruptcy Court? I heard your opponent for Gateway suggest that all of this was brought up to the Bankruptcy Court in response to Gateway's motion to compel the disbursement of those funds. So do the Bankruptcy Court orders require the disbursement of those funds and the guarantee by SBA and forgiveness?
I think they do, Your Honor. I think if you look at the language of both, first the order entering the preliminary injunction on the adversary docket, and then also the order approving the loan, it says that effectively the loan shall be made and shall be eligible for forgiveness and shall be guaranteed. So I think any fair reading of that does compel USF to lend and SBA to guarantee and forgive. And at least as to the SBA piece of that, we'd say that that was in excess of the court's authority under 634B, the anti-injunction provision. We'd
in
say
fact,
all of this...
It's right squarely rejected that very same argument, a claim of specific enforcement of a loan was expressly rejected in the Romeo, the U.S. case in the former Fifth Circuit. Is that not correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And that's, I think, on all fours here as to that piece of this, and then you certainly have the further precedent that comes from the Expedient case, which was also in the former Fifth Circuit and is binding precedent here. So you've got that piece of it. You've got the misuse of the 364B, which is about approving what the lender is able to do, or rather the debtor is able to do, but was misused to impose conditions on SBA and on USF Federal Credit Union. And we would submit if the court finds that it has jurisdiction to reach the underlying merits here, that it should conclude that just as the district court overstepped its authority in those other respects, it also overstepped its authority in substituting its policy judgment for that of SBA in determining that it was not legally permissible for SBA to adopt the rule that created an administrable means of determining whether loans were of sound value by looking to whether or not the applicant was already in bankruptcy. I've got
counsel,
further on. Yes.
Let me ask you one question. Suppose this had nothing to do with the suppose there was no requirement that the debtor not be in bankruptcy, or it was a underwriting consideration but not a requirement. Suppose the application form didn't ask and SBA approves the loan without any misrepresentation, and then later it finds out by whatever means that the debtor is in fact a Chapter 11 debtor and rescinds the approval of the loan. Is that and Gateway goes to the bankruptcy court and says, help us out here. Keep them from doing that. Is that a core issue, core function?
Sorry. sorry, Your Honor. I was expecting a question about 634B, not the CORA, based on the setup. Is that a core proceeding? I'm not sure if it is, because I'd imagine that that's something that could arise outside of bankruptcy. You could certainly imagine somebody bringing a suit in district court, APA claim, saying that this was, a breach of contract or a retroactivity, raising a retroactivity claim. I could certainly imagine a suit like that in district court. So I do question whether that would be a core bankruptcy proceeding.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to conclude. So if Your Honor has a further question for me, I'd be happy to answer it.
No, that's okay. Go right ahead.
For all of these reasons, because the bankruptcy court overstepped its authority in several respects, both as to its sort of threshold authority to decide these issues, and then ultimately in substituting its judgment for that of SBA, we would ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will take this under advisement, and we will be in a brief recess.